Welcome to the Transmedia Podcast, brought to you by Conductor's Crisis Simulator, the fastest way to build interactive team-based exercises. With Crisis Simulator, trainees feel like the exercise is relevant and the interaction ensures they're massively engaged, meaning you don't have people in class looking at Facebook or checking their BlackBerry. If you can use Excel, then you can create interactive experiences that feel like real life, and you're free to sell any sims you create to other Crisis Simulator customers. Why not try it for free now and go to crisis.conductor.com. That's crisis.conductor, conductr.com.
Hello, welcome to the Transmedia Podcast. I'm Natalie Rios, and today we have with us cybersecurity PhD researcher Andreas Hagman, who will be discussing his more recent war game about cyber warfare, which we had the pleasure to play test ourselves very recently. So welcome, Andreas. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
No, thank you for making the time. So first of all, could you please explain us what your game is about and how you play it?
Sure. So the game is loosely based on the UK National Cybersecurity Strategy. It involves two teams of players, up to five on each team, managing limited resources to achieve conflicting objectives. And the game is structured around sort of five fundamental constituents of cyberspace, as you see in the strategy and as I see it, which is government, business, people, military / intelligence, and critical infrastructure. And in the game, each of these must sort of attack, defend, and grow their vitality, as it were. And the aim of the game is for people to really engage with key cybersecurity concepts and terminology, and to understand some of the interactions between these constituents at a strategic level, and some of the fog and friction that you get inherent in cyberspace.
Okay, that's great. Excellent. So this game, it's focused more on the political side of cyber war, making decisions, how to act, what measures to take, rather than the hacking part of cyber war, if I can say it in that way. Can you tell us where the idea came from and why this approach and why this subject?
Yes, absolutely. So the game that you've seen and the one we're talking about now is actually the second game I've made. So to sort of go back a step, which will then explain the rationale for this game. The first game I made was more of a tactical simulation, which involved players moving their game pieces on a game board that was more like a computer network, and they were trying to infiltrate each other and place firewalls to defend. So it was very much a tactical simulation. But because tabletop war games, especially cyber ones, are quite abstract, there's sort of a disjoint between the medium, i.e. the game, and the scenario you're trying to play. So it's a very abstract medium, but a very high fidelity scenario. So I figured it was better, if you're going to use a very abstract medium, to also play an abstract scenario. And strategy is high level and abstract. So that's why I the game is focused on sort of the strategic side of cyber war, if you will.
Okay, that's really interesting. Yeah, because you say like it's a bit more open-ended and unexpected in a way. And I've seen that wargaming, it's like that. So it matches very well, this.
That's the idea, yes. And then the game itself really is inspired, I suppose, by the UK National Cybersecurity Strategy, and the one that came out in 2010. So it is dated, although I suspect the new one that's due out isn't going to change the core formulation, which, when you read the strategy, is really centered on this trinity of government, people, and business, which is where the sort of key constituents of cyberspace that the UK government sees as sort of central to security and prosperity of the nation.
Yeah, that is really, really interesting. So now that you mentioned that, can you tell us about the design and creation of the game? From investigating cyber war to transforming all this information, just like you said, into a board game where players actually make decisions and it portrays the way that the national security works.
Sure. So I've taken that core trinity of government, business, and people as really the what's shaped the game board in many ways. But then to that, I've also added the critical infrastructure and the military intelligence part, because I feel that any exploration of cybersecurity at a strategic level really must take those into account. So those five constituents on each side of the game board for each team really form how the game board looks. So that trinity, each side of the game board has a triangle with that key trinity in it, and they're essentially facing off against each other. And actually that basic shape has stayed almost exactly the same since version one of the game. The version you played was probably version 5.7 or something like that. And a lot of things around it have changed, but that key core concept of the Trinity has always been present.
Okay, great. That's the core of the game.
Absolutely. So maybe I could explain how the game works a little bit. So it's set up, so it's played over 12 turns, which is supposed to represent a year, January through December. The teams take turns to do actions with each of their entities. So they can do up to 5 actions per turn. Actions can involve spending resources to attack or to revitalize your own health or to move resources around the board. Or even buy assets from a black market that exists in the game. So, that goes on for 12 turns, assuming the game goes all the way to the 12 turns. There are each player gets, or each character, I suppose, in the game gets a player briefing with objectives, some of which are short term, some medium term, and some long term, which have victory points attached to them. And then at the end of the game, We tally up victory points based on objectives achieved, and we find a winner that way.
Okay, that's awesome. And can you tell us a bit of your experience designing all of this? Because you already said that, you know, the game mechanics and the game strategy matches these real conflicts and the real procedures of the way it is, you know, in real life. But what was your process designing all of these? All of these turns and, for example, roll the dice to attack, or what the sure. players are allowed to do. And I mean, did you work in a team, and how did you make decisions? How do you make changes?
Right. So there's no team involved in the sort of design process. It is just me. This is my PhD thesis, as it were. So it's me doing it. There are people helping along the way with user testing, but as yourself has been. But I think we can talk more about that later on. It's a solo effort very much. The dice roll is a really interesting dynamic that you brought up, and I think dice are preeminent in wargaming in general. And they what dice do is they introduce an element of chance, which you see is a really important part of war and warfare. Nothing is predictable in the real world, and nothing should be completely predictable in the game. And the rolling of dice really allows players to make their decisions around a risk appetite. So you find players who are really willing to attack and roll the dice and take the risk, and then you find players who really don't want to take any risk. And they'd rather just play the game without doing any dice rolling and just play it quite safe. But obviously the risk to reward ratio in the game is measured out so that taking risks can be heavily rewarded, but there is a potential for backlash there. So the dice element is definitely interesting, and that's one I think a game without dice or some kind of chance or randomness I think misses the point somewhat of wargaming, because it really is about trying to get people to make decisions and weigh up options.
Yeah, and to make them feel that risk is always there and chance is always there in a way, and you have to prepare somehow to those possibilities. I remember that when we played, something almost statistically impossible happened. Our opponents rolled a one twice, and they actually destroyed us. And that is something that can happen in any game. and in real life as well. You never know how it's going to affect, really. So how do you handle these type of situations where, you know, the game is over very quickly because of chance, because of something that statistics? And what's your takeaway from these kind of experiences?
Yeah, no, that's always interesting when that happens. And it's happened the other way as well, that people have had two bad dice rolls in a row, etc. So I think there's two key points to take away from that. The first is what you normally do is, if the game does end prematurely, as it were, is you pause there and you take stock of why that happened. What were the decisions made by the players that led to that point? Maybe even discuss what they would have done differently to avoid it. And then what you can do is you can, depending on logistical time constraints, you can end the exercise there. Or as we did in our game, is we had a little bit of in the industry call it a wizard wheeze, which is when you basically make something up to make sure the game can go ahead. So I gave you some extra health points, and we played on. And I can't remember the exact rationale we used, but
there was an argument defending that we could have survived the attack.
Something like that. As long as you can reasonably explain it, then the sort of value and integrity of the game isn't necessarily lost, because it's never a perfect simulation anyway, at least not at the level I'm working. So anything like that, any creativity that, especially if the players can bring it into the game themselves, is absolutely fine.
And do you think that is something that is actually useful in a game, that absolutely, you can come up with an argument and then it develops critical thinking in a way?
To me, that's the core purpose of the game. It's at least my game is not in any way accurate enough to simulate cyber warfare or cyber war at any real level. You're not going to get real strategic insights from it. But what you will do is get a chance to think critically about some of the issues that are explored in the game, and maybe create your own scenarios and topics to think about.
Yeah, so you would say that this is the main goal of your game, right? More than developing tactics to, to handle cyber war, is more about understanding and developing this kind of thinking. And
absolutely, I think that really the target audience for the game are people who need to make difficult decisions that involve risk management and perhaps right policy, but maybe they don't have as good of a grasp of key cybersecurity concepts that they would like. And for me, the game offers a meaningful and engaging way of talking about those concepts and interacting with them in a sort of social setting, and therefore getting more pedagogical outcome from it.
Yes, exactly. What would you say then were your biggest challenges developing and user testing the game? You can talk about the user testing experience and your challenges while doing it.
Sure. So, I mean, my most long-suffering test group are my colleagues at university. They played so many versions of the game, I'm surprised they want to play any more ever. But they've been very kind and humor me whenever I come with a new version. So they've been extremely useful. But as any deployment of the game, whether it's a government organization or a private company, even if it's not a testing session, if it's a proper playing session, it always generates feedback that can be acted on. So some really notable changes that came from user testing was things like some tactile stuff, like the first version of the game just had paper counters, but the game now has 3D cubes. Because they're easier to see, but also there's just an element of handling something like that makes it a bit more engaging. We now roll a D6 dice instead of a D4, partly because it's just more familiar to people. D4 dice, they work the same, but people just haven't seen them, so they might be a little bit not frightened of them, but perhaps disinterested when they see something that's a bit more specialized and not as familiar. I now assign objectives to players through the player briefings, whereas before we drew them at random, which wasn't as realistic, we thought. And objectives are now quantifiable, so we chase victory points for everything, whereas before they were objectives were a little bit more abstract, and people or players really had to attach their own values to them. So those are sort of some key things that have come out of testing, some major things, some challenges though that come out of it. Well, for me, that there's really two main challenges. One overarching, which is really reaching that target audience, but where there's a senior policy decision makers. Senior people don't tend to have a lot of time, so sitting down and playing a game for an hour and a half or 2 hours, if you really want to get the most out of it, isn't necessarily feasible for them. So that's proving to be something interesting. I've had people of various levels of seniority, but I don't think so far anyone at the level I was originally aiming at. So that there may be just some rejigging of the target audience to do there. But the other challenge I've got going on at the moment now, which is more gameplay related, is implementing new visibility elements. So the version when you played it, and I think someone pointed it out where, around the table as well, is that you can see everything that's happening on the board. But in real life, and especially in cybersecurity, the visibility is atrociously bad. You can hardly ever see what your opponent's doing, let alone yourself. So I'm trying to work out some ways of having hidden assets and hidden moves on the tabletop as well, to sort of reflect that real world a little bit better.
That is really interesting. You said when we played it that the discussion afterwards, one of the crucial parts of the game. Can you elaborate a bit about that? How do you think that, okay, the game is important, but the discussion afterwards more, is actually as valuable as the game, or is that the key takeaway of it?
Yeah, sure. So I think that ratio is absolutely right. I think the game is really literally only half of the value of the experience, and the discussion you have during and especially after is key. The game really is just a mechanism for A, getting people to explore the cybersecurity concepts and terminology, and B, make decisions, whatever kind of decisions they are. They have to make a decision to attack, to roll the dice, to spend resource here and not there. There's decision processes, and after the game, or maybe even during, but you don't want to distract from the flow of the game too much. So I usually tend to do it after. It's after the game you want to get people to reflect on those decisions. You go back and you say, okay, in turn four, you made a decision to attack. Why was that? How did that fit into your long-term strategy of the game? Was it just opportunistic? And you get people to attach some rationale to the decisions they made. And that's really where the key and learning outcomes are achieved, I think, because the game is quite abstract in itself. So the conversations are more important.
Yes, exactly. The feedback at the end is when you actually get everything that happened. One thing that I found really interesting, and I wanted to ask your opinion, is that you have this game and roles for each person that plays it, and then they need to they have their own objectives and they need to play according to their objectives. And it's very well written and guided, but at the end, people want to win. So they want victory points, and then sometimes they can take decisions, they can make decisions based on that rather than their own objectives within the game, within their role in the game.
Sure.
So I think that, of course, changes the outcome. And you would say, okay, I just want to attack because I want to have the victory. So how do you balance that? How do you handle that? Or do you think that's just part of the game? Or do you feel like games should be designed in a way that they control a bit of this human aspect there, and they need, the players need to respect the objectives and they need to play by the rules? Or do you think it's actually good that they are they make decisions based on emotions and more passionate decisions. What do you feel about that?
Yeah, no, victory points are an interesting game mechanic, and I think it's actually quite widely recognized in the wargaming community. The victory points are usually a particularly bad victory mechanic because people just chase the points and they lose sight of what the game is actually about. So there's definitely a sort of a people management thing, sort of element involved there for me as the game convener. You have to let people chase the points because that's what the game is about. And if they're not allowed to play the game, they're not going to engage with it. But you have to then at the end, when you do the conversations, is remember, okay, so for example, it's quite popular in the game to go all out attack in the last turn because the game is going to end anyway, so you may as well spend everything you've got. So you let people do that, and then afterwards you say, well, in real life, would you actually have spent all of that because you have a country to run after the game ends? The game ends, but the real world doesn't end, right? So as long as you can get people to recognize that they wouldn't have made that decision in real life and why, then victory points are useful. But no, you're absolutely right in saying that they're a little bit limited because they are very much a gameplay mechanic rather than something reflecting the real world as such.
Yes, I think it's tricky. And I imagine, I don't know, have you changed a lot of the way the victory points work in your game according to the feedback? Or
yes, so I did mention quantifying everything, and that was definitely a major change that happened. Also, with objectives being individualized to each character in the game, it's possible to then individualize the victory points. So instead of just mirroring them, so say UK government and Russia government has exactly the same victory point structure, is they're actually different, and therefore each side plays differently. So those are some changes that early versions of the game were just the same victory points for everyone. But now they're very much tailored to what is achievable for each character in the game. To essentially balance the challenge a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Make the game more engaging that way.
And now, what is the future of this game? And how do you know when the user testing stops?
Well, the beauty of it being a PhD thesis is there's not a sort of a commercial product necessarily at the end of it. So the user testing doesn't necessarily ever have to stop. It can keep improving right until I submit the thesis, and that's fine. That's sort of part of the research is seeing what feedback people give, and how that feedback reflects what they learned from the game, as it were. But there is a point where every gaming session you always get so much feedback, especially for people who are used to playing war games and board games. Then they feedback a lot on game mechanisms rather than the topic of cybersecurity. And to be honest, only a fraction of the mechanic suggestions ever make it into the game. Mostly because I have a challenge in balancing accuracy versus playability. So anytime I add a feature, that's likely to make the game more complex. And complexity is sort of the enemy of playability, if you will. I want the game to be really accessible. So people should be able to come in to the room, read the rules in 10 minutes or less, and we can get on with it, and then not get bogged down in how the rules work. So my self-imposed limit is to keep the rule sheet to one A4 double-sided, because I think anything longer than that, people will start to get switched off and get bogged down in the intricacy of rules. So that's a constant sort of balancing. Yeah, no, absolutely. So this, you can make something really simple. Snakes and Ladders is really simple, but you might not learn a lot from it necessarily. Whereas you can make something like, Monopoly, which is reasonably simple, but the rule sheets are longer than, they're twice as long as mine, but they're therefore perhaps more accurate and have some more intricate gameplay elements to them. But it's about finding that balance between accuracy and playability, and depends what you want out of it. I'm trying to err towards playability, but that's just my preference. I know some people really like complex games, but I think for my target audience, the simplicity is what's needed.
That's right. Just to finalize, I would like to ask you, what is your view on wargaming and gaming in general? And do you think it is a good approach to understand cyber war?
Sure. So, I mean, wargaming in general has proven uses throughout history and present day as well. But the leap to cyber security and cyber warfare has been kind of limited, at least in the public domain. I know stuff happens behind closed doors, but that's beyond the remit of my PhD research. So there are a few good games for education, but they're more targeted at a junior audience. I'm thinking of games like Control-Alt-Hack and Doxed, which are great, but their target audience is sort of high school, maybe undergraduates, or maybe even younger people as well. And I'm obviously aiming for a more senior audience. There's also some good stuff being done using gamification techniques, particularly in teaching like anti-phishing, spear phishing stuff, where there's a couple of companies that have products where you write a phishing email to your colleagues, and then you get points based on whether they click on the links inside, and they get points based on whether they recognize that it's a phishing email, etc. So applying sort of general gamification techniques to wider cybersecurity education topics is being done as well, and I think that's a general trend with a lot of things. Gamification is quite big, if you will. Everyone's doing gamification of some sort of, and I think that's just recognizing the fact that games can be a powerful learning tool. Cyberspace and cyber warfare as applied to wargaming, I think, is particularly tricky for three reasons that I like to sort of point out. One is sort of the non-spatial nature of cyberspace, because normally when you make a board game, a war game, it will be based on a historical battle or something, and you can take a real world map and you can put your grid over it, and you can sort of draw the outlines of the contours and the rivers and the forests or whatever, and making the actual game board is easy that way because it's based on the real 2D map. But cyberspace doesn't really have a map like that. You kind of get network maps, I suppose, but they're not really they're not meant to be maps as such. They're more visualizations of a topological layout, and they don't necessarily lend themselves to board game gamification either. They're supposed to be efficient, not fun. So there's a sort of inherent a challenge there in creating something or taking something that's non-spatial and making it into an actual physical artifact. The second reason I always point out is speed. So a normal battle could last, say Battle of Waterloo lasted a day, and you can take that day and you can divide it up into nice even chunks, and then you can base the characteristics of the game around those chunks, because the time chunks represent one turn, and then you can say that people move so far in one turn because that's how far they could move in real life in 1 hour or something like that. Really easy, but it's quite smooth throughout. So the activity level stays roughly the same the entire time. Whereas in cyberspace, if you take an incident like any given breach, like the Sony hack a couple of years ago, the activity level will wax and wane a lot. So you'll have the initial, intrusion or scanning where the attackers prepared their attack is a high level activity, but then they can sit on that information for probably quite a long time. Who knows? Maybe even years before they actually exploit the vulnerability they found. And then even then they might not do anything. They might just sit in there and monitor the network for a bit. And then they finally start extracting files. And that's another spike in activity. And that can go on for some time. And then you get dormancy again until the breach is discovered. And then you get a lot of activity, but on the defensive side. So there's real ups and downs. And the time frame doesn't necessarily flow as smoothly. These spikes can last for a long time, or they can be literally milliseconds, because we're dealing with computers. So the sort of speed at which operations in cyberspace occur make them sometimes tricky to make into a nice timeline for a game. And then the final thing, which we've already sort of mentioned, is the visibility aspect. With normal military capabilities, you can see them. You've got tanks and airplanes and missiles and those sort of things. You can see them and you can count them and you can measure them. But with cyberspace, or cyber weapons, if you like, that's much more difficult, because they only exist on a hard drive somewhere, on a memory stick or something like that. So how do you count these things? How do you measure what they are? How do you measure who's got what? It's very difficult. And then translating then this lack of information into some sort of game is definitely a challenge.
Wow, I think that's incredibly interesting, because, I mean, it's challenging developing a game or a board game about cyber war, but it actually portrays why cyber war is still like an issue that most people don't quite understand, or maybe they don't realize how important it is, because it's that's the way it operates. It's invisible and silent.
That's definitely part of the attraction of it is a lot of stealth. But yeah, it makes it harder to get it into public consciousness. Although I think that's starting to change somewhat. There's a lot more news floating around and some more like public rhetoric from government officials to do with cyber. And I think that's recognizing that it is becoming incredibly important.
That is just a part of war. It's not something additional. It's another weapon.
No, absolutely. It's indispensable. And the attractiveness of cyber is that it's not just limited to when you're at war. It's more used to prepare the battlefield, if you will, in a lot of information style campaigns.
Everything is vulnerable and you have to be prepared all the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Andreas, thank you so much for sharing all your experience and your insights with us. And I personally had a great time playing your game and have found it very interesting and educational. And I believe that games like these truly develop critical thinking and decision-making skills and can actually make you understand issues that you wouldn't understand by reading or any other way. So now, if you can share with us how people can find you or contact you online.
Yep, sure. So people can reach out to me on Twitter, by all means. It's my handle is Andreas_Hagman. And you can also find my Royal Holloway University profile, which I've created a tiny URL from. So it's tinyurl.com/HagmanRHUL. And that'll get redirected to my university profile.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you very much again.
Thank you very much.